it's been pretty shocking here to be inside that newsroom in the past couple of years. And it's fairly shocking to me that more people don't know what has gone on inside that newsroom.
Thank you for listening to Journalists Are My Heroes, the podcast where I talk to working journalists and journalism thinkers about the art and science of news and storytelling. They bring meaning to our daily lives. I'm Kyle Munson. I spent 24 years in local news, and now I'm in content marketing, and I plan to be a writer, producer, storyteller until I'm 6 feet under. Thanks for taking this journey with me for the last year of One Good Conversation at a Time. This is the season one finale to the podcast. I'll be back soon this fall with season two, contemplating some fun tweaks to the format, but every episode so far for me has been a win. I've learned more about local news in various corners of the country, and I've gotten to meet or reconnect with some great people. Now, this is the perfect season one finale because I sort of end up by looking in the mirror or coming full circle. I've been a longtime big fan of today's guest, Matthew Hansen. Until this summer, he was the Metro columnist at the Omaha World Herald. He spent 16 years in that newsroom. Like me, he's a child of the rural Midwest who ended up working in the largest newsroom in his native state, specifically as a columnist who got to chase his flights of fancy, not only across Nebraska, but around the globe to places like Afghanistan or down to Cuba. I loved Matthew's journalism, yet as more proof that he's my Cornhusker doppelganger, this summer he transitioned into content marketing as the managing editor of the Buffett Early Childhood Institute in Omaha. Now, I'm sure you recognize the name Buffett, as in billionaire Warren Buffett from Omaha, who in 2011 bought the World Herald, but has since soured on the financial viability of local newspapers. In this interview, Matthew talks about his front row seat to a billionaire's effort to salvage local news. We also talk about some of Matthew's great stories, including when he discovered that the most famous photo in American history was essentially a big lie. We even discuss Matthew's recent heart attack, one more milestone for this 39-year-old in what has been a wild 2019. That's enough for me. Let's get to my interview with my twin. Well, my twin, except that he has way better hair and can grow a decent beard. So let's hear from Matthew Hansen. This is our very first conversation. Well, hey, thank you, Matthew Hansen, for joining the podcast. And I don't usually begin these interviews this way, but I feel like we've led parallel lives in some cases. So here you are, former newspaper columnist from the rural corner of your state, Nebraska, who ended up working in the largest newsroom in the largest city. And I had a similar job in Iowa for many years. And so I'm a longtime fan and reader of yours. Why don't you, when you introduce yourself to people now, in a nutshell, how do you describe what you did as a journalist and what you're doing now in kind of the elevator pitch?
I don't know if I've figured that out yet. I mean, it was very easy to tell people what I did for 16 years, right? I was a reporter, and then I was a columnist. I didn't have to explain much beyond that. But now to sort of navigate what I used to do, what I do now is a little bit, it's a little more difficult and a little fraught. But what I'm doing now is I'm the managing editor at the Buffett Early Childhood Institute. What that means is we're starting a website that's going to be devoted to early childhood education, and I'm going to run it, which is very cool. I really care about early childhood ed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, that's the transition away from newspaper columnist. Obviously, people here know the Buffett name. They know a little bit about the Early Childhood Institute, although maybe not as much as they should. And so that's what I'm moving toward. But explaining to people why I moved from one to the other is where it gets a little fraught, as you maybe know.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, many thousands of journalists are now in different storytelling fields or content marketing. I hear you. I'm right there. And so maybe you're still, I mean, this has only been a matter of weeks or months, and so you're still figuring this out, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just finished my 15th day at my new job after 16 years in newspaper journalism. So, yeah, I'm definitely still figuring it out. I need your advice, I think. I need you to tell me how to sort of explain. Like, one of the things that I've been really struck by, and maybe you had a similar experience, is the idea that people are just shocked. They are shocked that I would leave a newspaper in the sense, not, I mean, they seem to know that times are bad for newspapers, mm-hmm. right? But at the same time, I don't know if the public, at least the public here, truly grasps, you know, what the state of the industry actually is. And I do think that leads to some confusion and some disbelief that frankly was a little surprising to me when I did announce I was leaving.
Yeah.
Is it similar for you?
Oh, yeah, I think it's very similar. I mean, on one hand, people wonder how could you – it's true. I mean, the job is such – there's such an open agenda. You can burn your creativity at every minute of the day, and it's a wonderful blaze. But so they wonder why people are leaving the industry, and then they go spend 3 hours on Facebook. which I don't disparage them for. I spend time there as well, but it's just, yeah, there's, I think only now is there more, a little more recognition of the underlying shift that is driving all these people to change jobs.
Yeah.
You know, let's start at the beginning. So one question I love to ask is, why the hell did you want to be a journalist in the first place?
You know, I can't answer that than other to say I never wanted to be anything else. I mean, and that is the God's honest truth. From the time I was 16, 17 years old, it's really the only thing that I truly considered. It was the first thing that I realized that I was good at when I started working for my high school newspaper, that I could write.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was some brief sort of, oh, maybe I'll go to law school when I was, you know, freshman in college, sophomore in college. But that was just, I didn't even know what that meant, mm-hmm. you know, much less I was never actually going to pursue it. Worked at the college paper, really loved it at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. And, you know, it just kind of went from there. It was never, I can't pinpoint why. Beyond the idea of it just felt supernatural from a really young age. And I, by the way, there were plenty of things that I knew I was really bad at, right? I mean, I was not, you know, some sort of all-American kid that was good at every subject and activity. So to find something that I was good at, like writing, was really... a revelation for me. And then a couple of, with this idea is I was a really shy kid.
Hmm.
So it was this way to enter the world. And I think a lot of newspaper journalists are like this. It's a way to enter the world, to satisfy your curiosity, to talk to people without, you don't have to necessarily at the start be that good at talking to people. It certainly helps, but you know, you don't have to make small talk. You don't have to talk about yourself.
Right.
You're there to answer questions and find out about their lives in a lot of cases. And people, if I found one thing, it's that people really like to talk about themselves,
yeah,
and their lives, and it aids that transition to becoming more outgoing, or at least it did for me.
Oh yeah, I'm right there with you. I was an intensely shy kid growing up. We really are the same person, and yeah, I mean, being a journalist, a license to be nosy gives you a complete framework for interacting with people, and then you just
right.
kind of you keep throwing yourself into the fire, and you get to kind of thrive on it. But it is, it can be just a little warping because yeah, you get used to firing away with the questions, and to what extent I to this day I wonder how good am I really as a conversationalist outside of firing questions at people. That is an open subject sometimes, I guess. But so, okay, so your Twitter handle is @redcloud_scribe.
Yes, it is.
And you are a purveyor of artisanal tweets on Twitter, which I love. Now, Red Cloud. So Red Cloud, Nebraska, this is a big part of your identity as well, right?
Yeah, it totally is. I want to say something about that Twitter handle first. That Twitter account was, I was not on Twitter. It was started as a joke by the guy who sat next to me at work who
no
thought
way.
I should be on Twitter. So he did, I mean, he was just basically being a dick. And he did, you know, he like named me Red Cloud Scribe and put, there's a weird underscore in the middle. I mean, he was just messing around. And then when, like a year later, when I decided to get on Twitter, I just took over the fake Matthew Hansen Twitter account, which had no, like 8 followers or whatever. So, I mean, it was the weirdest transition into Twitter. And then people started like thinking, you know, I mean, it was amazing, like the ego necessary to call yourself Red Cloud Scribe. I mean, and by the way, you know, Red Cloud is famous for one reason, and it's because the world famous author Willa Cather is from Red Cloud. So to call yourself Red Cloud Scribe really really pushes the bounds of so yeah, that's, it's always been a weird transition to Twitter. But yeah, Red Cloud, it is despite the fact that I did not choose that Twitter handle, it is a big part of who I am.
I guess the Midwestern rural sensibility shaped your character. I mean, to put it in an overly, you know, serious way. I mean, are you still kind of the rural Nebraskan at heart, or how do you think about that after navigating the rural urban conversation in journalism for so many years?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can definitely relate to this. I mean, this is super weird. It is really like talking to your long lost twin or something. We have never spoken before, but I can tell, I know before I say anything, like, oh, Kyle's going to understand this, right? It's the idea that I don't feel like a small town kid, and I don't feel like a big city kid. What I feel like is a Nebraskan, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And but having all those experiences, both the rural background. I mean, I grew up on a farm, son, grandson, great grandson, great great grandson of Nebraska farmers. First man in my family not to farm.
Mm-hmm.
So I have that and all that entails. And then, you know, I live in Lincoln and Omaha, and love both Lincoln and Omaha. I don't know. It just, that whole idea of rural urban divide to me doesn't really exist. And I think for most people in a place like Nebraska, it doesn't really exist. I mean, there are clear points of contention and controversy, but in that rural urban difference. But you know, most of the people, I mean, it's just so funny. Like, I don't know what the numbers are, but my sense is that half the people that live in Omaha are from a small, you know, Nebraska town. I mean, you can't go 10 feet inside of Omaha without meeting somebody who was from a place like Red Cloud. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's much more about places like Nebraska and Iowa and places that aren't Nebraska and Iowa, if that makes sense, where, you know, where you start to have a difference of experience, and it's really hard. It becomes harder to bridge that divide in some way. But I never really found it inside Nebraska. I mean, I've certainly found it in what other people say, or the fact that, you know, I've met a lot of Omahans who grew up here and who've never been west of Lincoln. So that, I mean, that certainly exists, but I don't see it as kind of unbridgeable as I think a lot of people do.
Yeah. I mean, I don't worry. I love both Omaha and Des Moines. I don't worry about the future of those cities per se. Do you worry about the future of Red Cloud, and, you know, as a viable community and the kind of community that you grew up in?
I don't worry about the future of Red Cloud near as much as I did 10 years ago, because Red Cloud itself is, I mean, Red Cloud is somewhat of an anomaly, right? Mm-hmm. With the Cather tie, with the, all these opportunities for tourism, and, you know, Red Cloud's moving in a positive direction in a lot of ways. I certainly worry about towns that are Red Cloud size that don't have that. And you know, the truth is, and you see this in Nebraska and certainly in Iowa, that there are going to be some places that don't succeed, that are, you know, continue to lose population, and the population ages, and the town is going to go away. I think that's inevitable in some places, but it doesn't have to be inevitable in all places.
Yeah.
And that's where we get into these weird black and white conversations about rural America. I mean, you know, and yeah, I guarantee you know this in Iowa. The X small town is doing, you know, they have good community leadership, and they figured out how to get a local bond issue to do, you know, X and Y and Z, and you know, they have four new businesses run by young adults on the main street. You know, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another place that might be 20 miles away, and the circumstances are totally different. The leadership is totally different. And, you know which one's going to succeed, at least in the short and medium term, and which one isn't. And there are certainly forces in all those places that work against them.
Yeah.
I mean, you're definitely running against the wind in most small Nebraska towns, but I don't know. It's doable. It's doable in some places here for sure, and I'm sure that's true in Iowa as well.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Now, of course, your journalism adventures ranged far beyond rural Nebraska, and your wife, Sarah Baker Hansen, still works at the Omaha World Herald, I believe, and, you know, food critic, food writer.
Yeah, she actually has the coolest job.
That's there you go.
Family. That's what I always told people. I had the second coolest Metro columnist.
So, I mean, you guys, you know, co-authored a book together on Nebraska, but then you've traveled. I remember you had reports from Cuba. I mean, you got to do a lot of different kinds of things. Stepping out of the newsroom, is there a particular, what do you see as your life's work for that period of your career? And is there something that most sticks with you in terms of what you produced as a roving journalist based in Nebraska?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think when I was a little bit younger, I definitely would have chosen the far-flung stuff. I mean, I spent a month in Afghanistan. I went to Cuba a couple times and did, you know, series about Cuba. And that was all, I mean, amazing in, you know, its own way. But yeah, I think the stuff that kind of is going to stick with me more is actually the stuff more about, you know, both small town Nebraska and just Omaha, like true Metro columnist type of things. Mm-hmm. That might not, you know, not necessarily the sort of stuff that wins awards, more the sort of stuff that people just really remember and bring up to me here now.
It's like, is it the kind of things that where you're a kind of a voice of justice or meaning for the community, like you're holding up a mirror to your local community and maybe telling the story of somebody who otherwise would have remained voiceless, that kind of a thing?
Well, I mean, I would certainly hope so.
Yeah, right.
I don't know if everyone would agree with that. The you know, I mean, I think a lot of the stuff that I tended to do, I mean, I have an overactive sense of justice, same as every Metro columnist in the country,
mm-hmm.
you know. But the and I did a fair amount of stuff where I would, you know, beat policymakers' head against the wall, or you know, bemoan policy X or whatever. And yeah, that stuff is fun and important, but. No, I think the stuff that sticks with people in my strongest suit, it veered more into the story about the person that nobody else was writing about. The you know, kind of featurey sort of human interest stuff that often was to pick a word, odder than anything else you'd have seen in the Omaha World Herald on a given day or a given week.
Yeah.
That, you know, and it could be sad, it could be uplifting, whatever. It was just stories that people hadn't heard before was kind of what I really think I ended up being known for at the World Herald.
Yeah, no, yeah, for sure. I mean, another piece I always remember is you dug into the question of identity around the iconic photo of the flag raising at Iwo Jima in World War II, right? And you found out that there was a misidentified Marine, right? It was Marines that were raising the flag. It was a, I think, it was a misidentified Marine, and just the kind of the historical maze you navigated in that story was an example of something that only happens really with good journalism and somebody who takes time with a story.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, that's actually an example of why my job was cool. I mean, I had the, you know, if you're a beat reporter and somebody calls you and says, "Oh, I have proof that shows that the most famous photo in American history is, you know, in fact, a big lie." You know, I mean, you should say, "Okay, you know, insane person, I'll, thanks for the call. I'll right. look into that or whatever," and you never think about it again.
Because we do get calls. Time. We do get calls where it's a complete just fantasy, or it's a dead end. I mean, that does happen. So yeah,
yeah, I would say that happens the majority right. of the time. But the in this case, and it's kind of a funny backstory. This guy named Eric. I can't remember if he emailed or called first. I think he contacted me a couple times. And I set up a meeting with him. He's an amateur historian, really interested in World War II, was saying this about how the photo, there were misidentified people in this famous photo. I went online and saw that a lot of people had claimed various things about it in the past and basically thought like, oh, this is a silly rabbit hole to go down. But I had already decided to meet with him. So it was at a coffee shop a couple blocks from the World Herald. I almost canceled. I mean, I came so close. I was thinking, I remember thinking in the minutes before, I don't want to do this. Like, I know what this is going to be, you know? Like, I'm just going to waste a bunch of time.
And one more crackpot to talk to, right?
Right. And I remember making myself vowing to myself, okay, half hour. Right, 45 minutes, because I had other stuff to do, right? Mm-hmm. And I got there, and lo and behold, the meeting that I did not cancel, I could pretty immediately tell this guy was legit, or at least he seemed legit to me. And, you know, he had really compelling, you know, evidence that actually the most famous person in the most famous photo in American history, you know, his son, Bradley, his son wrote Flags of Our Fathers, which turned into the Clint Eastwood movie by the same name, mm-hmm. was actually not in the photo. And this other guy who nobody had ever heard of was. I mean, that and basically it started, you know, that meeting that it was supposed to be 30 or 45 minutes started a year-long sort of off and on work to try to prove it to the point that we could get it, you know, past my bosses and into the World Herald. And lo and behold, after we did, and after I did some other stories and other people picked the story up, the Marine Corps reopened the you know, did an investigation themselves, used a bunch of technology that I didn't have access to, and agreed and, right. and changed this, you know, sort of foundational fact of World War II history. There's documentary about it now. I mean, there's several books being written. It's very cool that you know, that meeting in a coffee shop led to all that.
So you were at the Omaha World Herald when billionaire Warren Buffett swooped in, and I think it was 2011, bought his hometown newspaper, right?
Yeah.
And since then, we've seen, you know, what's been happening to the news industry. And it was last year that Lee Enterprises, another newspaper company, started managing the World Herald.
Iowa company.
I might note. Iowa got its revenge on the Nebraska Cornhuskers in some way. And then Buffett ends up, I think it was either at his shareholders meeting this year or last year, ends up, you know, giving a quote saying, like, newspapers are toast or something like that. And
right.
There's been unionization that happened, the World Herald unionized. This is a long preamble, a meandering way to say, I mean, did you kind of lose faith in the fact that billionaires could save the news industry? You know, we have, you know, the Washington Post and the LA Times and others, and there have been experiments. And I don't know, you had a front row view to kind of give it a shot with local news.
Yeah, and it's a really this right here is a really fascinating story, and it's interesting. I always complain that, you know, there are these amazing stories in Nebraska that if they happened somewhere else, you know, there would be five movies made about them. and this is one that, you know, you saw this with the Denver Post, mm-hmm, a couple years ago, you know, sort of. I mean, and that was a clear story, right? Evil hedge fund, you know, mm-hmm, Pulitzer-wise prize winning newspaper, stripped of much of its staff in a very short period of time. Well, what people don't realize, and what people in Omaha don't realize, is that from January 1, 2018 to today, so that's what, 20 months, mm-hmm, at this point? Mm-hmm. Don't quote me directly. I mean, these numbers are rough, but basically the World Herald went from somewhere around 125 newsroom employees to right around 60.
Yeah,
which is actually a bigger drop than places like the Denver Post.
About half the newsroom.
Yeah, more than half at this point. I mean, it's such a shocking, quick subtraction, mm-hmm, that it's a little mind-boggling to me that people aren't paying more attention to that story, especially when the newspaper happens to be owned by Berkshire Hathaway, you know, the company run by one of the richest men in the world. I mean, it's fascinating, and you know, it's not as clean as the hedge fund story. I don't really know who the hero is and who the villain is. I don't know if there are any heroes and villains. I think it's more a case of, you know, yeah. I mean, there's no saviors in the sense of sort of who's going to own you and how they're going to run you. I think. A lot of people made a lot of mistakes here, mm-hmm, that led to this sharp decline, and I think it's too bad for the city and the state. But yeah, that's a long-winded way to say it's been pretty shocking here to be inside that newsroom in the past couple of years, and it's fairly shocking to me that more people don't know what has gone on inside that newsroom.
This whole thing has been a recurring topic of the podcast, obviously, although I want to do is lift up the voices of people who care about journalism. But there is a fair amount of kind of anguishing over just the state of the business and what is going to happen to local news. And you're right, sometimes it's hard to parse, well, heroes, villains. It's not always easy to kind of to draw it in completely black and white terms. Another way that people tend to talk about it at this point, since we've been through so many, I don't know, rounds of cost cutting and newsrooms being decimated, is it's almost to the point of talking about it as a force of nature. You know, it's just like,
right,
we have, you know, the hurricane of social media and the erosion of the economic model. Just kind of, we're to this point now where in Omaha, Nebraska, you have, you know, half the journalists covering, you know, covering the city and the state and beyond in Western Iowa than there were before. Are you hopeful that there's some new nonprofit model or something else out there for local news? Or I don't know, have you talked to people who have convinced you of something like that?
I mean, I'm hopeful in the sense that I have hope. You know, like I can't, and just by nature of my personality, I think I, you know, I believe that this is important enough that, you know, there will be a future for, mm-hmm, local news. But, you know, what Warren Buffett thinks shouldn't be dismissed. I mean, basically what he thinks, and he said this publicly, is that some version of the New York Times is fine, the Wall Street Journal is fine, the Washington Post is fine, nobody else is fine.
Right.
And, you know, and there are obviously varying degrees at that point. When you get into that more regional newspaper and then into the small dailies and weeklies, you know, there are places that have done better. There are places that are where owners have put in much more investment. There are some limited kind of success stories in places like Minneapolis, for example.
Yeah.
But, you know, by and large, he's not wrong. I mean, far off from what feels like the reality of the situation. Now, does that mean that's always going to be the case, or that there aren't other models or other ways to monetize it, or experimentation and investment that you could do to try to pull at least a specific news organization out of that downward decline?
Mm-hmm.
I think there are, and it's too bad in my view that didn't happen, or it hasn't happened yet in Omaha, but I'm hopeful that it will. I mean, I can't imagine that, you know, that this will just be sort of the end of the story as it relates to a news organization in Nebraska's biggest city.
Well, transitioning out of that cheerful topic, I want to read a little excerpt of your writing here. That there are so many different things I could have read, but so this was just this summer you wrote this. I never understood much about the fragility of life, how truly and almost comically fleeting our time here is. I didn't truly understand that things can change as quickly as two ravenous kittens can snarf a half can of Purina. So I love the detail there and the, you know, using the half can of tuna. But obviously, you're a young guy. What, 30? How old are you, Matthew?
39.
39, yeah, not even 40. But you had this kind of a fluke freak heart attack that you survived this year.
I did. Man, we are really transitioning from one happy topic to another.
From the cardiac arrest of the news business to your own personal medical cardiac event. Yeah. But no, I don't want to make light of it, because I know number one, I'm glad you're fine.
Thanks.
And I just wonder, and you wrote like a good journalist, you wrote about the experience and kind of illuminated people to different issues that others might have. As I understand, this was kind of like a rare, basically a hole in your heart, right? That caused this.
Yeah. The hole in the heart isn't rare.
Right.
That's like a thing that a lot of people have and just don't know they do, and it doesn't matter. And they just live their lives without, you know, whatever, you just have a tiny hole in your heart somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But what doesn't often happen is that a blood clot doesn't often come from elsewhere in your body, get into your heart, and cause a heart attack in an otherwise healthy heart, which was the case for me. I think in that column I asked my cardiologist, I interviewed him for the column, which obviously, it made me his favorite patient, which was like a brilliant, I didn't even realize when I did it, I was going to get like perks, like, you know, my cardiologist just text me now, which is, you know, other heart patients would be super jealous of. But he had seen two other cases of something like this in his career. So, I mean, that's how rare we're talking about.
Yeah.
But the good news was that, and is that, it was a minor enough of a heart attack in kind of a specific place that it didn't cause hardly any damage. My heart function's normal. And then they couldn't really, and this doesn't really say this in the column because they didn't know this at the time, but they've done a bunch of tests on me since, and they basically say, well, we don't know why the blood clot was caused, which is frustrating in the sense that, you know, you don't have an answer, but it's good in the sense that there's nothing wrong with me as far as like other problems that would cause that to happen. So basically they think I'm fine.
That's good.
Which is a very, very weird thing to say 6 weeks after a heart attack, but no, I'm back. I mean, I think the first time I went and ran outside was maybe, it was not a month afterwards. And I mean, now I just go around and I wouldn't physically know that I had a heart attack. Like it's impossible for me to tell a difference between me now and me in June.
Did the brush with mortality change your outlook on life in any way?
Yeah, I think it did. I mean, and it's easy to say, like, that it felt so cliche in that column to basically try to explain that, because and you know, my sort of cynical journalist nature, you know, I recognize logically, well, that's what people think. after they have, you know, a major medical condition, but right. you know, can be fleeting, would be my assumption. And I, you know, I'm not far enough away from it to know if this, what I'm about to say, is true, but man, it is different. The difference for me is things that I thought were important. It just puts a different kind of lens on life in a way that I was totally not expecting. I mean, you know, I'm just not built that way. Yeah. That's not how I think about things. And I do see things differently. I feel less, I think, stressed by the random annoyances of life, less concerned with them in some way. I mean, you know, is it going to change sort of the bedrock of my personality? No,
right.
You know, I'm
right.
still the same person, but I feel happier. I mean, that's a weird thing to say
makes sense
to a podcast audience, but yeah, no, that is really the, to distill the difference between June 15th and, or I guess the heart attack was on July 1st, so the last day in June, and now that would be the difference. I'm kind of glad it happened. I mean, I know that sounds so weird, and I'm certainly, you know, I wish I could do without the medical bills and the
right.
all that, but no, I mean, it really had this interesting positive effect on me that I totally did not anticipate.
Wow. Well, you know, medically, professionally, this has been quite a milestone year for you in so many ways.
2019 has been a crazy year.
So, will you continue to write for other venues? I mean, you're not a Metro columnist now for a large daily newspaper, but you're working with the Early Childhood Institute. Are you going to write in other ways too going forward?
Definitely. Okay. I mean, I can't imagine, and that's one of the things that kind of. Telling myself that and trying to figure that out a little bit, how that was going to look, was one of the things that made it easier to leave. Because, you know, part of it is being the Metro columnist. It's such a cool job to kind of be at the center of, you know, city conversations in some way and sort of start conversations when you're lucky. So that part is super cool. But, you know, my first love in journalism was the writing. Mm-hmm. It was the act of talking to some people and writing a thing better than hopefully some other people could. And I can't imagine giving that up. I mean, yeah. that is as core to my identity as anything. So, yeah, I actually had a story come out yesterday. I actually wrote the story when I still worked at the World Herald, but it was a freelance magazine thing for a super cool organization and online magazine called Between Coasts. And it's kind of a good example of one of the things that I want to try to do moving forward, which is it's a story about Nebraska told to an audience that isn't Nebraskan. Right.
Yeah.
I would like to figure out how to do. I've spent my life and my career writing about Nebraska for Nebraskans. I would like to do some of it now, a little more outward facing, because I do. You know, I'm at the point in my career and life where I feel like I understand it
mm-hmm.
well enough to be able to do that in a way that maybe will help other people understand it too.
That's wonderful. Matthew, thanks so much for taking this time to talk. You know, it's good to have a conversation finally with my journalist, storytelling, content marketing twin west of the Missouri River. So
Iowa doppelganger.
That's right.
Yeah, I
That's
mean, right. It is, we even kind of sound the same. I mean, this is a little creepy.
Well, I it's an honor. So thank you. Yeah, thank you for doing this. And
no, best, thank you.
Best of luck with the Institute and your writing and everything else. And the next phase, we'll have to have coffee downtown Omaha in the Old Market or something.
Definitely. Let me know when you're, you know, across the state line and we'll hang out.
All right. Take care, Matthew.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for listening to the latest episode of Journalists Are My Heroes. And seriously, thanks for listening to this entire season, for not only listening, but supporting and encouraging me through all 18 episodes. It really has been a lot of fun. Growing up as a kid, one of the first things I ever did was simply produce mock radio shows into my little mono tape recorder. And throughout my journalism career, I've had the chance to be on radio in a number of different ways, to host both radio and TV and to produce podcasts. But this particular podcast, where it's just my voice talking about an industry that I still love, trying to find a future for local news, just to be one small part of that conversation and connect with some great journalists and storytellers around the country. The personal nature of this, voice to voice in my interviews, or me here talking to you, recording these intros and segues, it feels like, I feel like I'm that little kid again, just growing up in rural Iowa and wanting to reach out and to find a world full of stories. So it's been, like I say, every episode has been a win just for the people I've been able to talk to and just the whole vibe of this thing. So I know that everybody and their dog has a podcast, but if you want to do it and you think you have a good idea, there's not really a lot to lose if you take it seriously and you learn along the way. It's a good side hustle. So anyway, without further ado, you can catch all 18 episodes of season one of Journalists Are My Heroes in all the usual places, Stitcher, Spotify, Apple, and so forth. Find us on the Anchor platform. That's where this podcast is housed. And I am going to be back soon with season two. Please reach out at Journalism Hero. You can find me at Journalism Hero on Twitter and on Instagram. Please let me know what you think. Feedback is great. Ideas are great. And you can reach me at KyleLeeMunson@gmail.com. KyleLeeMunson@gmail.com. Take care.